Hi, and welcome to another episode of Hitchcast. This is Michael Piacenti, your host from Hitch Partners. And today we have a very special guest, Jason Vyok with GoDaddy, who we'll be introducing more formally in just a moment. But first, just a quick note that Hitchcast, the reason why we have the these episodes is to really provide a deeper sense of what are some of the trends and some of the interesting stories that we hear in the executive security world. Jason's background is rather unique. I had a wonderful opportunity to get to know him a few months ago, and we'll be going through a little bit of the history. Jason is someone that's started with the State Department and had tours of duty in Afghanistan and Iraq, went to Homeland Security, and then into the private sector. And so the evolution of his story, his journey, and his scope in his current role are quite fascinating. And we felt that this was an interesting topic to cover as the world of the CISO and the information side and the world of the CSO on the physical security side are becoming a blending topic. So without further ado, Jason, welcome to the program. It is great to have you, and thanks for making time.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Of course, of course. Well, first of all, how are you doing with everything? You're living in Arizona. Would love to sort of understand, before we even get into your background, how you're holding up in these times. These are unprecedented times. How are you, the team, family, everyone doing on your end?
Yeah, I think, there's two ways to look at that, right? How we're doing personally and how we're doing professionally. Personally, you know, I've got two boys, 10 and 12 years old. And I think we were probably at the sweet spot, if not to thrive, to at least survive well during this time. My boys are good friends. They keep each other active. They stay really engaged, and they don't need necessarily constant supervision. So that allowed my wife and I to, you know, transition quickly to working from home. And we're both in roles that, you know, are sustainable in the current environment. And professionally, you know, this is it's an interesting time, I think, for security and resilience leaders. It's make or break, effectively. You have the opportunity to, you know, demonstrate your value to the business beyond, you know, maybe the gates and guards mentality that sometimes you're viewed in, and contribute, you know, across really into business resiliency and thriving in these uncertain times. And so it's been a great opportunity to partner at GoDaddy across the different teams with people operations, legal, the business, and the larger global workplace team, to position us well in our exit and to plan and think about our return to office and deal with all the other little crises that pop up in between.
Yeah, you've had no shortage of interesting work to get into, and congratulations on keeping the boys kind of engaged during this time. I have two little girls at my house, and between Legos and online learning, it's tough to keep them engaged. So congratulations on the parenting piece too. It's not as easy as everyone thinks. So, great. Let's get a little bit into your background. When you told me, when we first met and you started going through your story, I was just fascinated by sort of the different twists and turns in your journey. And I wonder if you could offer to the audience sort of a little bit of a kind of a brief of how you got to where you are today. And then we can get a little bit more into this sort of evolved scope that you have with GoDaddy, which I also think is fascinating and really shows a true blend of what we're seeing in the trends today. So I wonder if you can kind of give us a little bit, to the extent that you can share, that would be great to learn a little bit more about your background.
Yeah, sure. Professionally, I had always wanted to be in federal law enforcement. During the late 90s, that was a difficult time to get hired. I had the opportunity to go to Air Force Officer Training School after my undergraduate studies. And so in 99, I commissioned as an Air Force Space Operations Officer. Did that for 5 years. Typical kind of government experience. They took the political science major and put them in a heavy math and science, you know, profession. But really was able to take, you know, my ability to thrive in the operations space and apply it. And then learn, right, the technical aspects of the role. Loved what I did, was exposed to great people, many of which I'm still in contact with today, but ultimately was really interested in federal law enforcement. And, you know, during that time in the military, 9/11 happened. And so the hiring mechanisms changed, for federal law enforcement, and had the opportunity to maybe pick the job that I wanted. Identified diplomatic security with the State Department as the place that I wanted to be, was able to transition to them in 2004. It validated my decision process pretty quick. It's a phenomenal organization, not just within diplomatic security, but to be a part of the larger Department of State and involved with foreign diplomacy. Through that experience, I had the opportunity to serve on President Karzai's protective detail in Afghanistan for a number of months early in my career. I supported protective operations at our embassy in Baghdad in 2006. Served on Secretary Rice's protective detail for 2 years, and then worked at the U.S. Embassy in Kabul doing personnel recovery of chief of mission personnel for a year from 8 to 9. And then did some time with the Joint Terrorism Task Force in Las Vegas as a part of the State Department working with the FBI. During that time, I also had 2 kids, and my wife reminded me that if I wanted to be a father, I should probably be there. And it made a lot of sense. And, so I made the choice to transition and had the opportunity to join Homeland Security, actually where my wife's family's from, in the Phoenix metro area. And did that for 5 years, worked cross-border, narcotics investigations. Kind of took little bits and pieces of the experience from the military, from the State Department, and was able to apply it in that role. While that's a great organization and I enjoyed my time there, we weren't going to promote because I wasn't going to move. Had an opportunity to look into the private sector. One of the things about being a DS agent is you learn from day one. Your job is to enable foreign diplomacy. So effectively, you're not the mission. And I think that message translates really well to the private sector. At the end of the day, the business exists to make money, and our job is to help it make money as efficiently and safely as possible. Was able to transition into an opportunity at GoDaddy, where they as a company were kind of at an inflection point as well. They were hiring for a gates and guards manager effectively, but their business strategy was international expansion. And so I saw an opportunity there to get in on the ground floor. Throughout the interview process, I think maybe they saw it the same way. Hopefully they feel the same way, but I can say from my perspective, it was a match made in heaven over the past 4.5 years. So, I can get into a little bit more about my time at GoDaddy now, if you want, or.
Yeah. First of all, I love hearing the background again. Thank you for all your service and those, and your sisters and brothers with you. It's amazing to see how much kind of diversity in the type of work. I do have a question before we get into the GoDaddy specifics, but was it, in your opinion, a tougher transition coming from, working abroad to, the Vegas role and then coming into sort of the Homeland Security piece in the Phoenix area? Or was it more difficult to go into the private sector, into GoDaddy, from that world? I love how you tied the two together and talk about the mission. But I'd love to know what was the hardest transition for you in the kind of the later pieces?
Yeah, it sounds like I know what I'm talking about when I say, the State Department experience prepares you for the private sector, but it's still a learning curve. Once you make that transition. I think the difference there is that in the government, certain things are expected and they have to happen. Whereas in the private sector, the company's, maybe not maturity level, but the company's phase of growth, indicates what they feel they need in terms of a security and a resilience program. And so I think the biggest learning curve for me was not just understanding what the business needed, but to understand when the business was prepared to accept it, because it's a balance act, right? I think people in our industry are often very forward thinking, and we have the luxury of outpacing the business just from a security perspective. You know, not trying to say that we're smarter than our business colleagues by any means, but we're looking a little bit further down the road, and maybe some of the protections or mitigations that we want to put in place, the business just isn't prepared for. So it's about understanding kind of that institutional patience and the recognition of where the business or the organization is at in their journey, and then marrying up, you know, what you view as the risk and threat landscape and the controls and protections, and mapping them to where that company is at, and communicating it in a way so that business leaders understand it.
Yeah, and you brought up a lot of great points there, but one point I want to dig into it just a little bit, or make a comment on for the listeners, so those in the CSO and CISO roles, is that one thing you won't ever see, well, not likely you will see on a job description, is the ability to do what Jason has just kind of connected the dots to. And that is, you know, we are expecting as practitioners in the CISO space to be able to look around the corner and anticipate what that next problem, challenge, program, framework will look like, as opposed to being reactive to it. It is the soft skill that many are hiring upon, the scale and the scope that you've been involved in, being able to know that so automatically that you can begin to think about things that are around the corner. And now with COVID and the work from home situations, it's being able to anticipate what problems are going to run into on our attack surfaces, and then just understand how we're going to approach that. So I thought that was a great point you brought up, and I want to reiterate it to everyone listening, because this is a key component to the difference between a tactical head of security or director and a CISO, is that the ability to kind of look around the corner and convince people that this, and influence those, that to make those changes and make those investments. I think that's the other key. So thank you for bringing that up. I'd love to get into you know your role with GoDaddy is fascinating to me too, because you came in, like you said, under a certain parameter, so to speak, and that role has grown, the scope has changed, and the business has really been, it's a fascinating business, as we, you know, in full disclosure, we're a GoDaddy customer, and
thank you.
Great service. But also it's just an amazing kind of story about how it evolved for you. I was wondering if you could touch upon that, because I think everyone would appreciate knowing that the scope that you start with may not be the scope that you're in today, and what does it look like?
Yeah, sure. You know, one of the things, and I think it goes to job seekers out there, when I was leaving the government, making that transition, I didn't know what I didn't know, right? I was thinking about, I need a job, and that job looks good. And now I think more about company culture, industry, compliance and regulatory requirements, you know, reporting chain, things of that nature. And the reason I bring it up is because, you know, GoDaddy culture, I mean, we just crested $3 billion in revenue, which I guess makes us not a startup anymore. But our culture is a scrappy one. And that really suits me and fits my nature. And what you find throughout the varying levels at GoDaddy are folks that have done really varied jobs. And I think hard work has been, you know, consistently rewarded. And so when I joined GoDaddy, I reported to the CISO to really start to think about formalizing the physical security program. And then during that time, you know, we started to think about what are the problems that we face, and how do we bring them together? And I got offered a really unique opportunity to grow my portfolio to include the cyber aspects of the employee. And so we created a team called Global Employee Safety and Security, where we brought together those physical and corporate functions, as well as you know, the employee-based or the end user IT security functions. You know, think endpoint security, social engineering, identity and access management, even, you know, hardware accountability. And what we're finding is that, you know, we were at the forefront of that converged security mindset. And the whole industry is changing in my mind. If you look at the way IT security started, it was about an edge defense. It was about this, you know, what we would now refer to as a private cloud, and how do we keep the bad guys out and our good stuff in? And as we've transitioned, you know, the entire world has gone through this digital transformation. And so now you think about information security, you think about cybersecurity, and it has multiple definitions. I actually did some graduate work in cybersecurity technology, and I wrote a short paper on just the definitions of it, and how it's all how it's all used, because it's used interchangeably. But I think about things now, you know, in terms of the movement to the public cloud, the user base really comes down to, you know, the device and the identity. You know, is the person who they say they are? Do they have access to the right things? And is the device that they're using safe and secure? The connection is a piece of that as well. But a lot of your traditional on-prem IT security things are starting to, if not deprecate, at least minimize. And then you see the highly technical aspects of security skewing towards application security and really thinking about security within code. And even if you're not a software company, and obviously at GoDaddy we are, but you are creating software to run your business, and you need to have somebody that's taking a look at that. And, you know, I think what we found in the industry is that people maybe with my background have the ability to pick up the basic technical expertise around the identity, the device, and the interactions. And your highly technical skilled security professionals are thinking a lot more about application security and you know, within the code itself. So anyway, that was the little bit of a diversion, but also had the opportunity at GoDaddy to stand up our offshore cyber SOC. So again, maybe not the technical expert on incident response, but understanding the mechanisms and really understanding operations, which I think is the key. You know, because that's the struggle. Technical expertise is a learned thing most ways, but the ability to operate is sometimes more of an instinctual, you know, skill set that you can nurture along the way. But if you have it, you have it, and it can be rewarded. One of the really interesting things, we got in the forefront of this converged security at GoDaddy, but as the company grew, so did the need for you know, those traditional physical or corporate security functions. And, you know, I think we recognize that as a group, that maybe the CIO organization and the CISO wasn't the best place for that to live. So about a year and a half ago, we transitioned over to the CFO organization and into our real estate team. And I think it's really interesting, because some of the same synergies that we found in IT security, we realized very quickly in the workplace team, maybe even more so. And so understanding, and I think it really validates the fact that security professionals are interdisciplinary by nature. You know, we shouldn't operate within the silo of our reporting structure, but we should operate across the span of the business. You know, we did not break those ties that we formed with our IT colleagues, and we keep them alive and well today, but we actually, you know, bridged an entire new gap with our real estate and workplace team, and I think brought on some additional functionality. And that's where we ended up today. And I think we're continuing to grow. I think that COVID in particular has shown us some value that a resilience program can bring in crisis management, and also helps us define what a non-IT services business continuity program looks like. Because I do think that's one place that there's some divergence. I think, you know, when you think about BCP in the IT space and BCP in the physical space, the outcomes are different and the methodologies are different and the way to get there are different. And sometimes embracing and acknowledging those differences is the key to success.
That's fantastic, Jason. There's a lot to unpack here. First, let me go back a bit.
Sorry.
No, that's great. I love it. This is exactly what I think everyone wants to hear. And first of all, I couldn't agree with you more that, you know, once you've perfected being an operator at this level and this scale, you know, having the more technical pieces, you know, adding on to this scope, it's something that I talk to CISOs about all the time and CSOs. It's just, when you have an innate ability to be an effective operator and an effective communicator on how you're going to operate, an effective orchestrator of resources and tools and people. Really, I believe that no matter what they throw at you, as far as the whether it's technical debt or whether it's new programs or whatever it may be, that you'll be able to perfect that just because there's a recipe for success there. And I think your background has sort of proved that. I mean, you've been offered, and you know, through obviously doing great work in other places, they recognize that you're a fantastic operator. And so, you know, here's some other things that you keep you busy, Jason. And here, try this, because we haven't done this. I think that's a great piece that CISO should take away from this, that to seek out other opportunities to celebrate your wins, and to make sure, you know, you do it humbly, but to make sure that you're always looking to increase your scope. And I think you've done a fantastic job of that. One other point on the BCP piece, you know, this is a huge trend that we've seen in the CISO space, that before, with business continuity planning and disaster recovery, the CISO and CSO, whether it was on the, you were purely on the physical side or purely on the information or a hybrid, it was always something that they were involved in as a major component, a player. And now, so with COVID, we've actually seen many CSOs and CISOs sort of take over as the program leader for that, and being the one to communicate to the executive team and to the board. And it sounds like you've had that responsibility too. I wonder if you could talk about, was there a change since COVID on BCP, or were you always kind of leading that charge? If so, was there a change at all in the intensity and the consistency or the frequency that you had to communicate that?
Well, you know, our IT services BCP plan is coordinated through a different organization, and I think we do it the right way, you know, which is you put it on the product owners and the service mm-hmm. owners themselves. And so really it's about a standards and validation program. And that's mature and maturing every day. But it's also not necessarily, you know, one of the things that you have to think about in a BCP program is what are we protecting against? And so the risk and threat landscape in a services outage is much different, you know, potentially, than what we're going to see in kind of the, you know, the tactile, the tangible world. And so we, you know, I'm a big fan of resilience. It's one of the reasons I put it, you know, in my business title, is that it's about strengthening the way that the business operates. And we had started to go down this path in December of last year, and start to call out, you know, the availability of our people and our places as a risk. And, you know, do we have a formal, you know, BCP program, as, you know, maybe the way some of the professional organizations would identify it? Like, absolutely not. And I think what you're finding is, you know, and I've had these conversations with some peers, is that there could potentially be an overinvestment in some of that planning. You know, I mean, what they always say is, you know, the best laid plans don't survive the first shot in battle. And I think some folks have found that, right? If your BCP program were, you know, a number of spreadsheets with a bunch of tabs with hundreds of tasks, that's fairly inflexible. And I think what, you know, a resilient organization is one that has a framework to manage crises. You know, I think actually ITIL provides a great, you know, mechanism mm-hmm. for it when you think about, you know, change, incident, and problem management. I mean, that, you know, why reinvent something? That works, right? So when you want to move everything away from a crisis down to an incident, down to business as usual, and you want to do that based on probability and impact. I read a great article the other day, and I don't want to talk too much about it because I haven't really internalized it, but it was what is it? Black swan versus gray rhino. So I don't know. Are you familiar with the gray rhino?
I am not, but I'm going to
look that up. Yeah. So, you know, really encourage anybody in this industry to check it out. But black swan versus gray rhino. And they talk about the black swan as the unplanned event, right? The formation of the internet, right. The, you know, 9/11, And maybe even 9/11 is, you know, one of those hybrid examples. But, you know, the gray rhinos are the things that we kind of know about, but we don't really invest a lot of time or energy into it. And those things are out there. And I think you're going to find a lot of organizations that pandemic planning was a gray rhino. Right. You know, do people know it? Sure. Did some people have pandemic plans, you know, with doctors on staff and epidemiologists and, you know, infectious disease folks and all that stuff? Absolutely. And I think that's very industry based, you know, but others, you know, did not have a plan there. And so I do think it's important to have a framework to operate within, you know, that's kind of a high level checklist. You know, I think the way to look at it, one of my buddies is a career now retired fighter pilot. And, you know, they talk a lot about checklists in the flying world. Checklists are great to make sure that you go back and do everything that you need to do. But if you don't know the first three steps in every checklist, you're probably going to crash because you don't have time to open the book for the first three steps. Right. So the first three steps have to be from memory. And they have to be practiced. They have to be internalized. They have to be efficient. You know, steps four through X, you literally, you know, create and go back and reference when you have that instant to, you know, to contain the problem, you know, just to right size it, to get the basics going so that you can go back and check the list and say, okay, take a deep breath. Start at step four. Does this apply? Now I'll start to work through. And I think as long as those frameworks exist, now obviously this is industry specific, right? There are certain high probability, high impact events that people need to checklist, and they are repeatable and consistent. But I think if you went back and looked at history, and I have, you know, there's slight differences to every pandemic. And some of those slight differences even have to do with the age in which it occurs. And so if we plan for a pandemic 3 years from now, we don't know the technology that will be in place to mitigate the impact 3 years from now. And so it's important, you know, to keep those plans fresh and sustainable. And one of the ways to do it is not to overplan.
Right. A great point. And also a great point on the framework of the recipe too. I mean, I hear this a lot with pilots. I have a friend that took me up in a flight a couple of years ago. You know, we get to the runway, you know, get to the little area where the, you know, checking in with the tower goes through each of the first 12 steps, and then something goes wrong. Got to start over again, right? Like, but it just flowed off his tongue those first 3 to 5 steps. And because you're so familiar with it, and that translates extremely well to a framework in business as well, or really to a communication style in business as well. I think, you know, if you're familiar with it, I'm definitely going to go check out the gray rhino concept. But I think we're all living it right now as well. So definitely will hit home on the note of communication. I mean, I'm curious how you have you had a change in the way that your style of communicating your team for security awareness programs, or just overall communication with your team, specifically your security team? How's that changed since COVID? And do you see it changing again as we kind of move through a somewhat back to normal environment, assuming a massive second wave doesn't come? Curious about how you're communicating to your team.
Yeah, you know, GoDaddy as a company was just really well positioned. You know, I mean, I think one of the points of pride the entire, you know, crisis response team, you know, felt was we were able to get our customer care folks home, which is traditionally an on-premise operation. And we did it in a very short amount of time so that the business really was able to, I think, withstand the impact. But ultimately, the corporate shared services, the technical community, you know, myself included, we were able to transition to work from home fairly quickly. Because we were already doing it, you know, maybe a couple days a week. We're a very distributed workforce. We're very Zoom focused. And I always joke around, we went through an acquisition a couple of years ago, Host Europe Group in Europe. but they, you know, prior to that acquisition, GoDaddy employees domestically really didn't use their cameras on Zoom. It just culturally, it was not something we'd all be on Zoom calls. And frankly, I think, you know, a lot of people were multitasking and maybe, you know, somewhat checked out. But after this European acquisition, part of their culture was they always had the cameras on. And as we're trying to build relationships with folks that, you know, we may never meet face to face, you saw it filter through the rest of the company. And so, you know, in the COVID environment, everybody talks about now, like, you know, my wife, for example, their Microsoft Teams meetings now have, you know, cameras on where maybe they didn't previously. But for us, it's what we've always done. So I think, you know, the big thing that I've tried to focus on, which I'm really, it's not one of my core strengths, is make sure that the team has time to step away. Right. I've actually put a little bit more focus on starting off calls with non-work related interactions, because I think that, you know, we are all stuck in our homes. And, you know, sometimes I think most humans are social by nature, and they crave it. And the absence of it makes it hard. You know, you asked in the beginning how the family's doing, and, you know, we're really well positioned. I mean, we're going, you know, before it got into June in Scottsdale, we were going for walks every night and bike rides every night. And, you know, so there's a lot of social interaction, even if it's within the family unit. But I think the thing now is really to think about the, you know, the mental health of the workforce. We can fall into working all the time when we work from home, particularly during these crises. And, you know, this is now the new normal, as everybody refers to it. So you can't be in crisis mode for 6 months. You know, we're just not structured as humans to survive or thrive in that environment. We're going to make mistakes. So the comms part has actually probably caused me to get a bit more human. My team may disagree with that one. I don't know. But, you know, just putting that focus on the social interaction, the human interaction, and not, you know, just kicking off the meeting and jumping right in and hitting it from a business sense, you know. But in terms of the medium, that's been an easy one, I think, for us organizationally.
That's great. And this humanizing the communication flow is something, you know, we've been talking a lot about and blogging a lot about. Even down to like interviews, I think those that are interviewing and the interviewers that we speak with in our process, you're really trying to get them to understand that, you know, where you might have just sent a quick email with some details, with lack of details, saying, you know, hey, this is what we'll cover. Really to really get down into the level of, you know, this person is sitting at home, need to be empathetic of their time. They're bouncing around between the 12 Zoom meetings that they have every day, and really need to provide a level of detail that you may not have done before. And that flows through the interview as well, and really talk to get, because you're not going to have that connective, you know, human, you know, meeting face to face likely. It's very, very unlikely. Maybe 20 or 30% of the time you'll be able to hire someone that you actually are meeting face to face in an office environment. The other 60 or 70 or 80% of the time, it's just not going to happen. And so you were really encouraging all the companies out there to really think about, reinventing their interview style and making it more personal, which, by the way, is not easy for many, many technical people out there. They were still trying to figure out interviewing 101 as it was, not asking them to do that in these times. But I think people have really stepped up, and it's great to hear your story around that. Jason, this is great. We've covered a lot. I don't want to keep you from the superhero work that you're providing, but I just want to reiterate, I mean, what you have built in your journey at GoDaddy and even prior to that, and just seeing the building blocks of your career, really an interesting, fascinating, and inspiring story. I encourage everyone to sort of think about some of the concepts that Jason's covered here. And by all means, you know, think about where your scopes can be expanded, as Jason has, his opportunity to do so, and that the organization that you work for allowed that. Any final thoughts on your end, Jason? I just wanted to kind of wrap up here and let everyone
know. No, appreciate the time. And, you know, frankly, if people are interested, I always encourage, you know, those to link in with me. And we're an open book, happy to benchmark, have a conversation offline, anything like that.
Fantastic. We appreciate it. We'll certainly create a place where people can link into you. So Jason Vioch, thank you so much for your time here on Hitchcast. We appreciate it. And keep doing the good work out there. You're definitely inspiring. So thank you for that. And that is it for this episode. Thank you, and please join us again on the next episode of HCast.